Welcome to episode 9 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith, and this episode is part 2 in a series about the Bible called Who Wrote the Bible? Do you need any more information than that? Basically, we're just looking at the history of this book, who wrote it, the cultures that the various stories came out of, yada, yada, yada. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Elliot Friedman, author of the best-selling book on the origins of the Old Testament, Who Wrote the Bible, as well as The Exodus, The Bible with Sources Revealed, The Disappearance of God, and a bunch of other great books that you should definitely check out if you're interested in the Bible. The goal of this conversation is to learn, not to convert anyone to any religion. I'm not going to try to convince you to be a Christian or a Jew or an atheist. We're simply going to be looking at some of these old biblical stories and looking at how people have read them in different ways throughout time and how people have come to read it the way they read it today. And also getting Dr. Friedman's take on all this as someone who is very intimate with these old stories and the places that they came out of. And so without further ado, here is my conversation, part 2 of my conversation with Dr. Richard Elliot Friedman. All right, we're here again with Dr. Richard Elliot Friedman. Good to have you with us.
Good to be back. Thank you.
This time by phone, because we couldn't get it together in person. I won't be drinking any more of your beer this time, on the bright side.
Yeah, I'm awfully sorry. I could send you a case, you know.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I got to say before we get started, the last episode that we did together has been the most popular episode of the podcast so far, and I have seen several comments that people who listen to it have purchased a few of your books. So I think we've made up for the fact that I checked your book out at a library and then you gave me a second copy of 2 of your books.
Oh, good. So
I guess we're even now.
Or I have to give you royalties on my royalties, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. Better pay up. Well, I thought it'd be great to do a follow-up conversation. I'm personally just so excited that people wanted a follow-up conversation because there was a part of me that was really unsure what the response was going to be because the Bible's obviously such a polarizing topic. But everybody from all walks of life, I've seen comments from Hindus, from Christians, from atheists, from Jews, from people of all different religions saying that they loved how the ideas were presented and they loved the conversation and wanted more. So here we are. We're back by a popular demand somehow.
Can I say, I looked at some of the comments too. There are quite a few. And I looked at a fair number of them and almost all of them were, whether they agreed or not or whatever, they were very positive and they were polite to each other. It wasn't the way these things often are where they're calling each other idiots and all. And I don't know if that's just that's who your following is, or maybe we inspired them with all that talk about loving your neighbor.
Well, yeah, maybe it was a little bit of both. Part of this podcast is about creating open-minded conversation. And so it's just, I mean, that was a huge test up to that point. People had been playing nice in the comments section, but I was really nervous about that one because obviously some people have their entire sense of identity wrapped up in this book. And so I wasn't sure how it was going to go, but you're right. People were, for the most part, completely amicable with each other. And I think that's awesome because that's what we were talking about, was loving each other, like you said.
Yeah.
So quick intro on you before we dive in. You are the author of Who Wrote the Bible, The Exodus, The Bible with Sources Revealed, and numerous other books. You've kind of changed my life. I just love your work. I love your perspective on things. It's unbiased. It's objective. And it is really refreshing because as somebody who wants to know more about the Bible, it's hard to find opinions of actual scholars who are familiar with the not only the writings, but also the cultural times that they came out of and what was going on with the politics at the time. And, you know, I think it just gives you a totally different perspective on the Bible than some of these other books that you see on bookshelves typically. Last time we talked, we established, and we'll just kind of go over the cliff notes here of everything we discussed in part 1. We established that monotheism shows up on the scene around what year?
It depends at what point you mean monotheism. I mean, when I said that there was an early merger of Yahweh and El as one God, which to me means the monotheistic impulse was present already then. Well, you're already back in the 12th or 11th century BCE there. But Jeremiah around 600 BCE is still criticizing the people for worshiping at least the goddess of heaven and maybe other gods as well. So it was even later than that where, you know, it finally catches on and all the parents are teaching the kids, oh yeah, there's only one God. But it's a gradual process there. You know, you can see hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, so polytheism was all we had for thousands of years. And that's why, you know, you have like religions like Hinduism predating Judaism by 6,000 years and things like that. And then around this point in time, people started getting the idea for some reason or another that all these gods were bad inherently and that there was just one God. And so we started kind of changing our perspective on the purpose of God. And we can get into the other things we discussed, but I guess, why do you think it was, real quick, we can just stop here for a second. Why do you think it was, is there any indication we get from the text why people felt like they needed to drop polytheism in this part of the world? Because obviously it still exists in some parts of the world today.
I think most of us don't even realize, you never learn about that pagan religion is the most successful religion of all time. I mean, in terms of time, I mean, for thousands of years, pretty much the whole world was pagan. Christianity is the most successful religion in terms of the number of people who have been in that religion because there's so many more people in the world now. But for thousands of years, everybody was pagan. They were fine with that. So something very powerful must have moved us humans to so successfully have replaced it with monotheism. I mean, in theory, is one God a higher concept, a better concept than two or five? We could fight about that. But
Well, the earliest polytheistic religions had gods that were based in the natural powers of the world, like fire and the, you know, moon and sun and wind, and it was a way for them to describe where these forces came from, right?
Yeah, and that really is what it was. The in pagan religion, it's certainly in the Near East, the gods are the forces of nature, and that's why most of the Near East, where the storm wind is the most fearful thing, the chief god is the storm wind. He's called Marduk in Babylon, or Ashur in Assyria, or Baal Hadad in Canaan. But I mean, he's called Zeus in Greece, but they're all the same god. He's the wind. Whereas in Egypt, where anybody's been in Egypt knows that the primary force of nature in Egypt is the sun. And then you learn about Egyptian religion. Yeah, the main god was generally the sun. So big surprise. The gods really reflected what was going on in nature.
Yeah, it was a way for them to describe where these forces were coming from, because they had no other way to, I mean, first of all, they had nothing else to think about because they didn't have electricity and, you know, devices and things like that to distract them. But so this is the stuff they thought about, was like, why is it raining? Why is it super hot today? And why is it cold in the winter? And they had to come up with narratives for these forces because they had nothing else to think about, but also because there was clearly something that was, you know, it was a part of what kept them moving forward as a people. And so it's only natural that it evolved, the idea that that God eventually went from being several gods to one God.
Yeah, it's funny you said narrative, because I mean, the way you talked about the gods in the pagan world was through myth, which means to say you told a story. You didn't sit and philosophize or do theology about them. And so a myth isn't just any old story. You don't get to make up any story you want, and that's a successful myth. It had to reflect the reality of nature. So like in the ancient Near East and in many parts of the world, we've all heard of various myths about some god or goddess who every year dies and then is reborn. And it's that they die at the end of winter, and they're reborn. I mean, they die at the beginning of winter, and they come back in spring. And I used to explain to my students in San Diego, I'd say, well, you guys don't understand this because you don't know about it. In the rest of the world, we have these things called seasons.
Yeah, not in California.
No. But so LA people don't know about this either, I suppose. But in most of the world, there's a season called winter where everything gets everything is dying all over the place. All the green goes away. And a lot of the snow.
And we don't feel the effects of this because of the grocery store now. You know, this is not a part of our culture. We just graze past this stuff. But this used to be a way of living, like the way to live.
Wow. That's a good point. So nature religion was conquered by Trader Joe, apparently.
Yeah. Well, their prices are so fresh.
Yeah. Yeah. So in spring, of course, though, then suddenly all the plants come back and there's flowers and people are running through the park in slow motion and falling in love and it's sunny. And so the way you would describe that would be a myth of Dionysus or Persephone, a god who dies, spends part of the time in the underworld. So the myths aren't just any old stories. They reflected this reality in the world of nature. And that gave birth to some of these fabulous myths and practices and all. So that when monotheism came along, biblical religion, it wasn't just arithmetic. It wasn't one God versus five. That's how you teach it to little children. It was a whole different concept of what a God was. Yahweh, the God of the Bible, is not more identified with any one force in nature than another. You can't understand Yahweh better by contemplating the sun than by sitting on the shore and contemplating the sea.
We've used the word myth a couple times, and I want to kind of touch on that because I feel like that word can be a red flag for some people. Another word that is synonymous with myth that's all over the Bible and is not taboo is the word parable. So just because we're saying myth doesn't mean we're saying it's not important or it didn't happen. I would actually say that no matter what you think about the Bible, there are universal truths in it that can be taken from it if you are willing to read it open-mindedly. But I just wanted to say that just because we're saying myth doesn't mean that it didn't happen or that it wasn't important.
Yeah, well, when we use the word myth and talking about ancient Near Eastern religion, we have a definite meaning in mind, which is it's a story about gods. And it's a story that reflects something in nature, like that myth of the god or goddess who dies in the winter and is alive again in the spring. Those aren't true, but they are true in the sense that they reflect realities in nature. If you use the word myth when you're referring to some stories in the Bible, then you have to be much more careful. And in Greek and classical scholarship, they use the word myth in a completely different way, which I'm not using here.
And the reality is that there is lots of mythology in the Bible. Most people today don't believe that the world began with a 7-day creation and a talking snake and two naked people. Most people are able to get their heads around the idea that the Bible is full of this, even if you believe that it is word for word inspired by God. So anyway, sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to clarify what we meant by myth so that nobody's confused or misinterpreting things. Before we get too deep, I noticed one question that popped up a lot in the last episode we did together. Some people had a lot to say about the documentary hypothesis. And I guess I was just wondering if you could defend that briefly and why you like that one as opposed to the supplementary model and the fragmentary model of the Old Testament.
Well, the main other model would be the five books of Moses were written by Moses. The documentary hypothesis is a product of the last few hundred years of scholarship and research, some of it by priests, rabbis, and ministers who were also scholars. So it wasn't seen as anti-religion. And it was the recognition that the five books of Moses were not written by Moses or by any one person. It's several people whom we can identify now, not by name, but the period when they lived and what was going on and what their concerns were and whether they were a priest or a lay person. You know, we identify them with the famous letters J, E, P, and D standing for the different sources in the texts. And you can get books like the one I mentioned last time, my Bible with Sources Revealed, or other people's books, where you can see these different sections of the Bible in different colors and fonts. You can follow each one or read them all or whatever. And that's pretty much the dominant view in biblical scholarship. But there are a great many variations on it, and that's what you're asking about. One of them is that people have a supplementary hypothesis, which means there was originally one source, let's say it's the J source, and then there's another source, the priestly source, which tells stories differently, but that it was never written as an independent alternative to the J source. It was that somebody wrote it around the J source. They took it and kept adding it and supplementing what already existed. My own teacher, Professor Cross, thought that the priestly source was written as a supplement to the J source. Other people have said E is a supplement to J, or P is a supplement to E, or there's every variation you could imagine. And I just reject all supplementary hypotheses on the grounds that once you separate the sources, you can read them and they each read straight through with hardly a break. And that shouldn't be possible if they were just never written as an independent document, if one was written around another one. You know, you can just read J all the way through and there's only an occasional break. You can read P all the way through and there's never a break. Now, how could that be if those were just written as pieces around another work?
And you've also argued before that the vernacular is different in each one, right? I think you said that in Who Wrote the Bible, that there were words that just simply didn't exist at certain points in time, or spellings of certain words that didn't exist at certain times. And so you can tell by what words were used, the vernacular that was used when it was written roughly. And that lines up with the documentary hypothesis, right?
Yes. For example, you could look at the Song of the Sea, also called the Song of Miriam, which is the oldest thing in the Bible. If you look at that chapter in Hebrew, you don't have to be a superstar Hebrew scholar to look at it and find 7 or 8 or 9 words in it that are just not formed. They're not written the way you wrote Hebrew in later periods. The grammar is different. So you can see it's an earlier stage. And it would be like if you and I just started throwing in Shakespearean words here, that would be suspicious. So, to some extent, this amazing linguistic scholarship, which is barely 100 years old, has made a big contribution to this.
Is it unfair to say that supporters of the supplementary and fragmentary hypotheses are entering the discussion with a presupposition?
I don't know. I don't like to accuse anybody of that. People constantly accuse me of that, where they say, well, we all come to this with our presuppositions, and I reject that.
I do,
no
too.
Preconceived. Yeah, I mean, we're scholars. We're supposed to look at the evidence and follow it where it takes us. So some people will say, well, you're starting with the presupposition that miracles don't exist. And I go, no, I'm not. They'll say, you're starting with the presupposition that there isn't such a thing really as prophecy. So when you see a prophecy come true in the Bible, you assume that it was made up after. And I go, no, I didn't. I look at the evidence and try to figure it out.
I've heard it argued, and maybe this is in one of your books that I read, the prophecies of Jesus in the Old Testament, the messianic prophecies in the Old Testament that Christians claim were about Jesus, were actually in reference to the Davidic kingship, because Israel wanted an ethical king, and they finally got it with David, and then they had a few kings from his line, and then they were conquered by the Assyrians, and they were exiled, and then they were kicked out of their promised land, all this promised land and their promised king that they'd had. Been promised for centuries, they finally got it, and then they were kicked out and they had nothing. But the prophecies, from my understanding, about the coming Messiah were in reference to the Davidic line and the kingship of the Davidic line, not so much a universal cosmic savior coming to save us from good and evil.
Well, that's how most biblical scholars would read that text. It's certainly how Jews would read that text. I certainly understand that to an evangelical Christian, it reads differently. Yeah, then you are talking about presuppositions.
Because Judaism it still exists today, and this is why it still exists, because Jews disagree that Jesus was who Christians say he is.
Yeah, well, Jews and everybody else who's not a Christian was not persuaded of that.
Right. Well, I guess also you have people who, I mean, in order to be a Christian, you have to accept Judaism as well, and so I mean, there's lots of people that just don't accept any of it. So I guess that's what I was getting at.
We're living in a strange time, a good time, I think, that a lot of both like New Testament scholars and just regular church-going Christians are looking more and more at the Old Testament, more and more at the Jewishness of Jesus and what was happening in his world, rabbinic texts and all that, and studying together with Jewish scholars. I mean, it's a great time, really. And I'm not a New Testament scholar. I don't want to go there. I honestly think it'd be great if you can get a really fine New Testament scholar to talk New Testament, because I never try to present myself as an expert on something where I'm not.
But you did go to Harvard Divinity School, right?
Yes, that's interesting, because I'm Jewish and I have a degree from the Jewish Theological Seminary, but I also did my doctorate at Harvard Divinity School, where all of my teachers were Christians.
I do think there's a genuine conversation about this stuff that's trying to build, but it's struggling to come to a head because people just don't want to talk about it with an open mind. People don't want to discuss it from a objective, analytical standpoint. I think one major thing that keeps people from entering the discussion from this standpoint is fear. Fear that they may discover something that's contrary to what they already believe, and that they may have some more learning to do on the other end of that. And, you know, the reprogramming of your mind that can come along with a discovery like that can be intimidating for some people. It can be scary. It can be just more work than somebody's willing to put in. Also, I think there's, ironically, a lot of fear-based mentality that keeps people reading a book like the Bible in a very specific way. And so this is where the conversation usually dies. It usually ends somewhere around morality, like whether morality is just a product of evolution, a byproduct of our higher stages of our brain, the limbic system and the neocortex, or whether morality is indicative of some higher power, be it God or gods or whatever. People kind of get off the boat right here and they don't want to talk about it anymore. But the reality is, we know that a certain amount of our ethics comes from evolution. You know, we know that there's ants that enslave other ant colonies that look different from them, and it's literally racism in bug form. And one of my most recent episodes was with evolutionary biologist Brett Weinstein, and what he talks about is, and it's kind of a taboo subject, but it's kind of science now, it's literally in our genes to be skeptical of people who look differently than us. And but you know, what makes humans so special is our ability to assess the program we're running and to accept or deny it. And so you could say that we are obligated to talk about this stuff. We are obligated to evaluate the program we're running and decide if it's working for us or not. And I think that includes how we look at our religious texts.
Yeah, let me take the classic one. The Garden of Eden, the first story, really, of the Bible. There's the creation itself, and then there's the first story of people. In it, you know, they have the choice. The garden has these two trees. One is the tree of life. If you eat from that, you live forever. And that's not forbidden. They could eat from that. But the other tree is the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And that one's forbidden. And when they choose to eat from that one, the result is they're driven out of the garden. So that's why humans lose access to eternal life. And the price was that we get knowledge of good and bad. There's two different ways people have of understanding what that means, the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Does it mean, in an absolute sense, that acts out there are good or bad in themselves? It's wrong to be naked. It's wrong to commit murder. It's wrong to lie, just in itself, always and for all times, and that's that. And it's only after you eat from the tree that you can see those things and know which are the good and which are the bad. Or is it that deciding something is good or is bad is a divine power that's initially only God's? And when humans eat from the tree, they acquire the power to make decisions themselves. Oh yeah, I think murder is bad. I think stealing is okay. I think whatever. And you can see it's all the difference in the world. And in the story, after the humans eat from the tree, God says, the humans have become like one of us, knowing good and bad. So I've always taken the second view, that it's not that all acts are moral or immoral in themselves, but we humans, both in the story and in reality, biologically and all, acquire the ability to make such judgments. Now, everything you just said about the evolutionary thing may prove me wrong.
Well, it's funny that you took it back to the Garden of Eden, because that's actually where I want to go next.
Don't we all?
Yeah, let's all go back to the Garden of Eden. Sounds kind of nice. I ain't got no problems. I don't have to wear clothes. And it sounds kind of amazing. But I think the idea that some of our ethics are derived from evolution is amazing. And I think that reflects what we already know. We are the only animal that we know of that is aware of ethics and is self-aware enough to evaluate the sum of their decisions and, you know, alter their path depending on what they want to achieve in life. And we've got to take ownership of that ability if we're going to navigate the trajectory we're on with civilization, I think. And what's fascinating to me about the Bible is there's a specific idea I want to talk to you about. It's a book. It comes from this book called Ishmael, written by Daniel Quinn in the 70s. I think 1973, I believe it was written. I don't think this was his idea originally. I think this has been kind of an understanding that's kind of, it's growing now. I think it's becoming kind of mainstream, but it's not quite there yet because some people, it's kind of controversial. But basically it suggests that the earliest parts of the Old Testament, the creation account, the Garden of Eden story, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, all the way up to Noah, everything before Moses. It derives from the agricultural revolution and the origin of civilization. And there's a lot of things that line up with this idea in the Old Testament that simply don't make sense in any other context, like Genesis 3:17, cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. Genesis 3:19, in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. Genesis 3:23, so the Lord God banished him forever from the Garden of Eden and sent him out to farm the ground from which he had been taken. There's so many scriptures in Genesis that seem directly, that make so much sense in the context of the agricultural revolution, which was happening in the Fertile Crescent, which experts believe the Garden of Eden to have been in the Fertile Crescent, even if it was just allegory. All these things seem like major coincidences until you line them up and it's like, well, maybe agriculture and Garden of Eden are the same story, and that's why they both supposedly originate in the Fertile Crescent, and all of our earliest civilizations come out of that place. And you know, you have the very fact that Adam and Eve are put up against this tree that is supposedly the barrier between the knowledge of good and evil, which makes them like the gods. Their god was creative, and they discovered they had the ability for the very first time. They weren't hunting and gathering; they were planting these seeds, and they could grow their own food. And they became like God in that moment. And so they did, for the very first time, have the knowledge of good and evil. They had the knowledge of who would live and who would die. They would be killing off animals to protect their crops, like deer and rabbits and foxes who would be trying to eat their crops. These animals would have been seen as intruders, not food, and so they'd be killed off for the purpose of extinction, which disrupted the food chain for the first time ever. And the story goes on to depict this exact same picture with Cain and Abel, the story of Cain and Abel, the classic story of ranching versus farming. Abel was a shepherd, and by this logic, Cain would have represented the world's first agriculturalist, or the son of the world. Adam and Eve would have technically been the first farmers by this argument, because they ate from the fruit first, and then forever they were forbidden to live in the garden. The garden would have been the hunter-gatherer life they had before, which was when humans were living off the land, and we know this happened at some point, so it's not a crazy, outlandish thought to think that this could be what this story is in reference to, because this would have been highly controversial, because it would have disrupted the food chain, and it would have, uprooted a lot of families, because hunter-gatherers traveled together in families, and nature just simply didn't allow for a lot of children, because if you were constantly on the move, it just wasn't conducive to having children. So the idea of, you know, that's another thing that's interesting about the Old Testament. God constantly telling Abraham that he's going to multiply him like countless as the stars in the sky. The idea that he could finally settle down in the promised land and have children and multiply, and he would be the father of nations. What do you think about this idea?
Yeah, I really do see the logic of it. That initially in the garden, God says you can eat from all the trees. You can eat all the fruit. So initially they're pictured as not working.
So that's nature.
Yeah, they just, you're hungry, you go pick an apple or pear. And then it is because of what they do that gets them in trouble that there's several curses are put on them. And one of them, he says, now that the ground is cursed, you're going to have to work it to get its bounty. So that seems to reflect the transition you were talking about, that initially, and the hunter-gatherers don't work the soil, they get their food. And so after that, Adam and Eve, it's understood they have to work. So that story is the etiology of work. It's why we have to work, and particularly why we have to do farming work.
There's several verses in that passage where they're getting ejected from Eden, where God tells Adam and Eve that they are going to be responsible for their own life now. And that's totally in line with this idea. It's so fascinating. And I've just not been able to find anybody else who I can talk to about this that actually knows where these texts came from. You know, I just want to have the conversation and see if it's even possible. I'm not necessarily trying to prove that this is true, but I want to see if we can prove it as untrue, at least, so that I can just stop thinking about it. Because if it's true, the implications are huge. And if they're false, then it's just a dumb story. But we already don't know, most people don't know what to make of the first main four stories of the Bible, the Garden of Eden, the Cain and Abel, and Abraham and Noah, most people don't know what to make of those. I think for most people who believe the Bible is divinely inspired, I would argue that they think the Bible starts with Moses in their mind. They know that those other stories are there, but they just kind of say, well, those are old. We don't know where those came from. I don't know what to think about 7-day creation, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just not going to worry about it. But this angle actually makes sense of it in a way that is applicable to today. And there's also several other fascinating parallels with this idea, like, Cain went on to found one of the first major civilizations that is still successful today. It was the first metallurgy, and they invented music, and, that was Cain. He was also, Cain killed his brother Abel out of jealousy because God didn't respect his sacrifice as much as his brother's. And then God gave Cain a mark to identify him as the killer of his brother for the rest of his days. And this is fascinating because what happened directly after this point is, evolution brought us out of Africa and we evolved from apes into Homo sapiens. And then we moved up to the Fertile Crescent and would have started growing food around this time. And then we kept moving, migrating north. And the further north we migrated, our skin depigmented. This is all science. Our skin depigmented so that we could absorb more vitamin D from the sun because it was colder the further north we went into Europe. And so we literally evolved. We didn't need the protection from the sun like we did in Africa. And that's why, black people don't wear sunscreen because they have that natural protection built in. And us white people, we're just like helpless in the sun, because we came out of Europe, but we all came out of Africa. And that's what's amazing about the Cain and Abel story is Cain kills his brother, and we're all brothers and sisters is what that idea says. And so the whole racism debate right now is so out of control because nobody's saying we're all the same thing. Everybody's just focusing on the differences. And so this perspective on the Bible for me is more in line with the ethical aspects of it, like we discussed last time, than any other perspective of it I can think of.
Well, you just covered so much there. I don't know where to plunge into that.
I'm sorry. You can tell I've been maybe thinking about this a little too much.
Yeah. Well, not too much, just great.
What do you think about the idea of the divine individual, the idea that...
Every time you say that, you lose me because I never heard the expression divine individual until I met you. And you've explained it to me once or twice, and I still don't get it. I gather this is some idea specifically of Jordan Peterson's or not.
I don't know if Jordan Peterson came up with this or not. I don't know where this idea originated from. He certainly talks about it a lot, but it's not hard to... get your head around the concept that when we were hunter-gatherers, there wasn't purpose for humans like there is in the context of civilization. We all have to kind of play our part to make the machine work, in civilization. So the idea of the divine individual, you come play your part, the machine goes round, and then you can, in exchange, have a life at home with your family that a family would be almost impossible to sustain out in the wild just because of how much you're moving around. It just wouldn't be compatible,
Yeah.
You don't like it. You're not buying.
It has nothing to do with the stories in the Bible. It just has nothing to do with them. I mean, God first speaks to Abraham in Ur. Ur was like a big civilized city in Mesopotamia. And there'd been civilization on Earth. And this is only a story. Remember, Abraham is only a story. The person writing the story is even 1,000 years later. So there had been civilization on Earth for several thousand years before our author is writing the story. And, for thousands of years before the oldest thing in the story takes place, like Abraham,
This is where the conversation gets a little murky, admittedly. And this is why I'm interested in picking it apart in this way, because, there's so much talk about this idea. And it's interesting, and it does have profound implications if there's any merit to it. But... you're right. Civilization is older than these stories by quite a bit. I think where people usually hang their hat on with this idea, and just for the record, I'm not hanging my hat on this argument. This whole podcast is about exploring ideas, whether I like them or not. Just exploring like what people are talking about and, kicking around what it means, And so this is an interesting theory, whether or not you subscribe to it. But the people who hang their hat on this idea hang it somewhere around the fact that The Garden of Eden was in the Fertile Crescent, which is where the agricultural revolution first exploded. Not that it hadn't happened in other parts of the world already, but that's where most of the development happened, right?
Well, it began, I imagine, around the same time in the Fertile Crescent and in Egypt, you know, in Asia and in Africa. I imagine they're both many thousands of years BC. And that the Garden of Eden is supposed to be there is a new one on me.
Oh, you've never heard that?
I can imagine why people would think that. I mean, the story is written by people who don't know anything beyond that.
Sounds like I'm giving you a history lesson here.
How do we know where the Garden of Eden was? I mean,
yeah, I mean, obviously, nobody knows if the Garden of Eden was even a real place. But
oh, I know that. I do know the answer to that. It wasn't a real place. It's just a made-up story. But where it's being pictured in this, what, do you think it's true? The world began with two naked people and a magic tree and a talking snake? I mean, what, come on.
I personally don't think that. That's not what I'm getting at. I'm saying maybe there was some mythological gift wrapping around the actual events in the Garden of Eden or the Fertile Crescent or whatever, agricultural revolution, whatever you want to call it. This idea isn't mine. This idea is one that, you know, I think the very first place I read it was in Daniel Quinn's Ishmael. And then I hear Jordan Peterson talking about versions of it. I don't know where he got it from, but this is something that a lot of people are talking about. And I think people just go along with people like Jordan Peterson. Not that I personally have any problem with what he's saying. I think he's a really smart guy. But I'm just interested in, like, what do historians and biblical scholars actually know about this stuff? Because Jordan Peterson is not a Bible scholar. Jordan Peterson's a psychologist, a really well-versed psychologist who knows a lot about a lot of different topics, but you're a Bible scholar. You know, that's why I'm interested to hear your opinion on this stuff.
And as you see, as you hear, we're not talking about it. I mean, all these things you're saying are mostly new to me. They're people from outside the field interpreting something or other in a Bible story. We aren't talking about it a whole lot. It's out there, I suppose, especially as anthropology becomes more and more the thing in my field. But no, I every now and then I'll be at some conference and somebody in the middle of the paper will say something about hunter-gatherers or something, but I don't even see where it fits in the Bible story. It would have to be prior in the story to Cain and Abel, but they're only the second generation there is in the Bible. So all that leaves is Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve are definitely not hunter-gatherers. They're gatherers, but they're not hunter-gatherers.
No, they're not hunter-gatherers. That's not what this idea says. This idea says they would be the first people, whether or not it's historically true or a parable or some kind of myth, you know, that was important to them for some universal reason. Adam and Eve would have been the first people to live in civilization, the first generation, and Cain and Abel would be the first generation to be born into civilizations, which would mean that Adam and Eve, by this logic, at least represented the very first people transitioning out of hunter-gatherer cultures into civilization.
And the evidence for that is what?
Well, first of all, what else do you make of the Old Testament, especially the parts before the P source shows up? Because before that point, you know, I mean, what would have been the motivation to write what they wrote?
Well, why would I write about the Pilgrims and George Washington and Christopher Columbus? I mean, they were telling their history. First ones to do it. Nobody ever did it before, ever, anywhere on earth.
But you said yourself that you don't think that Adam and Eve were real people and that the Garden of Eden didn't really exist and it's just made up.
Course.
So if you, of course, yes, and I'm with you in that respect. This argument kind of loses its steam right around the point you start getting down to whether or not oral tradition is something you can hang your hat on with the Old Testament or not. And I think people like you probably get really annoyed, probably is my guess, when people start talking about whether or not oral tradition influenced the earliest writings. Is that correct?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't see what oral tradition has to do with what we were just discussing.
Well, if oral tradition brought us the creation account and the flood story and, you know, a bunch of stuff, which it probably did because we see it in other writings too, so we weren't the only people who, you know, the people who wrote the Bible weren't the only people telling these stories. So if it could have existed only through oral tradition for a while, that would be,
you know, it's not evidence per se, but it means that it's possible, at least, that these stories could have come from hunter-gatherers.
No, because the flood story did not come from oral tradition. The flood story came from written sources, because you've got the flood story in the Gilgamesh epic. It's 1,000 years older than the one in the Bible, and it has facts in common with it. So we know that it wasn't oral. We know it was written.
Okay.
The Gilgamesh epic was the most famous, second most famous book in the ancient world. So you see, so at every jump, I'm giving you a hard time. I don't want to, but I don't know what to do here.
You're not giving me a hard time. I personally, as somebody who grew up with the Bible, I think that this telling, this perspective of it is really fascinating. And there's a lot of interest in this perspective of the Bible. So I'm just curious about it from a kind of universal perspective. And I think that there are a lot of other people that will find it interesting for that reason too. So it's not you're not letting me down. I want to know what you think about this stuff because I think other people will want to know as well. But there are a lot of parallels. I think this is a really compelling idea because there's so many, how else do you make sense of so many verses in the old, in the creation story about like what it means when, you know, God tells Adam and Eve that because of what they've done, they're going to have to till the fields for the rest of their days and they'll only eat by the sweat of their brow because of what they've done. And they'll never get to live in this peaceful garden where everything they have is just supplied for them naturally. Now they have to, you know, work from their own means to eat.
The Garden of Eden story is a story of etiologies. Etiologies meaning stories about origins. How did somebody get their name? How did a custom start? How did something that will get to be the way it is? The Garden of Eden story is genius because it does 11 or 12 etiologies in a matter of like 20-something sentences. It explains why snakes don't have legs or wings. It explains why roses have thorns and other plants have thorns. It explains why you can't just get food out of the earth easily. You have to work it and farm it. It explains why people wear clothes. It explains why people are embarrassed over nudity. It explains why women have pain when they give birth to babies. It explains why men dominate women. It explains why, above all, we die. And it explains why we humans are able to make judgments about good and bad. Now, I don't know how many I just rattled off, and I didn't get them all there. So, antipathy to snakes, reptiles. It's doing all of those things. And one or two of them have to do with agriculture. So, on the one hand, yes, it's relevant, it matters. And on the other hand, we don't want to make the mistake of making that some kind of perspective on the whole Bible when what it is an element out of 11 or 12 important elements in the, you know, the foundation story at the beginning of Genesis.
Okay, that's good. Devil's advocate, though. You just said that the creation account in Genesis depicts an ideology, several ideologies that are very important and very specific, yet most modern people today would not say that any of these ideologies are relevant or applicable or valid at all today. So what do you make of these texts? What do you make of these ideologies in a world where we have hard, cold, very concrete facts and descriptions for things and where we came from and why things are the way they are? What we know now doesn't line up with the Genesis account, so we're just kind of forced to throw the baby out with the bathwater in a way. But this idea, the idea that the early biblical stories are inspired by the agricultural revolution, gives context and meaning to these stories in a way that is still applicable to today. And, you know, it's really powerful what it suggests. It basically suggests that civilization, technology, agriculture, it's like a double-edged sword. It suggests that it's a good thing, but that there's a danger of it that everybody has to be aware of that runs the risk of putting us all at odds with each other and our environment.
Well, that's all over the place now. People, of course, are concerned about that very thing as civilization in our lifetimes, in my children's lifetime, has just made this technical leap. And it's fascinating to see that already when those stories were written, which is about 3,000 years ago, and when they take place, which is even more thousand years ago, they already got the point that, yeah, there's good and bad in this. Oh boy, civilization. We got all this, we get buildings and we get to eat animals and oh yeah, we have to have wars and weapons and people enslave other people and people want to be kings while other people are regular. They were deeply aware of that. A lot of the biblical laws are precisely to stop the feudal system that was dominating the rest of the ancient Near East, laws that tried to keep it so it's not just a few wealthy people at the top and the poor masses at the bottom. And that they were thinking of doing that and passing laws in the Bible that do that. Whether you think it's from God or you think humans, you got to admit they were brilliant, and their purpose was to not make it a world of kings and slaves. That's extraordinary. And going back all the way where we started, I made a big jump there, but going all the way back to the creation story and Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, yeah, they were already aware that our world has all this bad stuff in it, but also has a lot of great stuff in it. And all this, there was a price to pay for it. Oh boy, we get to make judgments of what's good and bad and have all kinds of freedom of judgment to do that because we ate from this tree, apparently, that gave us that. But the price of that is now we can't get to the tree where we could have eaten from it and lived forever. So I think they got it loud and clear that our world is a mixed blessing and you keep trying to make it better. The interesting thing is you're supposed to pursue wisdom, right? Is the ultimate level of the Bible where you get not only knowledge, but wisdom. And what's the big book of wisdom is the book of Proverbs. And in the book of Proverbs, what is wisdom? It says it is a tree of life. It's the path back. Because at the end of the Garden of Eden story, you know, the tree of life is not destroyed. It's just made inaccessible. And there's this notion that ultimately we could get back there, but it's a path we have to earn on our own and keep achieving wisdom. I don't know what you think about the present generation, if we're moving closer to that or not. I have a feeling I know what most people's opinion would be about that.
Zing! Oh, man. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The scary thing about that is there's a lot of surface-level wisdom with, you know, social justice warriors and stuff. And, you know, some of it's good. It's not all bad. I actually like what you just said. Everything that you said about the Bible there, the wisdom that's in it is obviously there. And it was the first to do a lot of things that it did. But you just don't like this hunter-gatherer thing, huh?
I understand it in terms of the history of the development of our species. I don't see where it comes up a whole lot in the Bible. So as a Bible scholar, I don't think I have a lot of wisdom to offer on that. I think, you know, you need a really good anthropologist who knows about the early stages of development of the human species. They could probably give us all a great lesson. I can only talk about the way the Bible portrays the early generations of humans. And they have us strangely in our earliest generation, right? By Cain and Abel, already one of them's a farmer and one of them's a shepherd, meaning they're already settled, civilized guys by then. They're the whole hunter-gatherer stage of human development is somehow missing from the Bible. Now that's interesting. I don't know why that is, but presumably because it happened so long earlier that they didn't know.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about this perspective, and there's obviously more that we can pull out of this idea, but to break away from it for a second, what's amazing about the Bible, first and foremost, is that what Christians and Jews say about it is true, that although it was written by many different people at many different times in many different cultures, it contains a consistent narrative, and that it contains a lot of wisdom. And you could even say that it was the origins of ethics on a civilizational level. And the Bible ends in Revelation. If you're a Christian, it ends in Revelation. And it depicts civilization going up in flames. And so I think it's, if you read it this way, from the perspective of the agricultural revolution and civilization and technology and the fact that these things run the risk of keeping us at odds with each other and our environment if we're not careful, it encourages unity. It encourages us to figure out how to navigate our biggest problems today, because otherwise it's going to go up in flames, is what this idea says. And I don't think anybody denies that possibility right now.
Just to start at the end there, people should not say that civilization and morality and ethics begins with the Bible. I mean, there were 4,000 or 5,000 years of civilization prior to the Bible.
Right.
And the pagan world, they were not all just evil people running around stealing from each other and burning each other's houses down. We have ancient Near Eastern law codes, by like the Code of Hammurabi and all that have particular morality too. And they also, you know, they say you should be kind to the poor and to the weak and so on. And shouldn't murder, shouldn't burn other people's houses down, shouldn't break into anybody else's house. I mean, they were civilized. They lived in cities. They had art. They had literature. They had law codes.
But it wasn't on a civilizational level. Like they weren't, I think the idea that we covered last time, unless I'm mistaken, you suggested that the Bible, the Old Testament, was the earliest source of a civilization adopting these as a whole. Like if you're going to live here, you're going to treat the alien like your brother. You're going to follow these. And some of those laws were in relation to sacrifice and, you know, religious regulations that were kind of new to the scene at that point. But obviously people weren't bad before the Bible. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just maybe suggesting that it was the beginning of ethics on a civilizational level, maybe. And that could be totally wrong too.
I'm hesitating because after all, if you study the Hammurabi, he was the king of Ur and a major city in Mesopotamia, and there's the law code. It was standing there. It's still standing, and people judged cases based on it, and, you know, it was around. And so there were whole civilizations besides biblical Israel that had standards. Egypt too, they had their values that worked as, you know, for a whole civilization. The things that were innovations in biblical times, first of all, I said history writing, which nobody had ever done before. And the principle that you had to be kind to even the people who weren't members of your group, that was new. You don't find that anywhere in the ancient world until the biblical times. And monotheism, of course, because there had just been one brief flirtation with monotheism that we know of in Egypt under Pharaoh Akhenaten, but it didn't succeed. So monotheism, caring about loving your neighbor, even if he's not even one of your own group, and history writing are, you know, three of the things that are distinctive about ancient Israel. But, you know, some of my best friends are Babylonians, you know. They were okay.
Yeah, I didn't.
Well, I guess not. They conquered the Jews, but outside of that little blip, you know,
was it the Assyrians or the Babylonians that conquered the Jews? I thought the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians and gave the Jews back their land.
No, the Assyrians conquered the kingdom of Israel. The Babylonians conquered the kingdom of Judah, which was the Jews.
Okay.
And then the Persians conquered all of them.
The Persians.
It was the Persians who let the Jews return to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple and all. That was in the 6th century BCE.
Well, it sounds an awful lot like the Persians were the Messiah they were waiting for. Another thing that's interesting about the picture of the early Old Testament from the perspective of agriculture and civilization is, and we touched on this earlier, but I think it's worth expanding because it's really fascinating. This would have been the first time when hunter-gatherers were leaving their families to pursue individual careers to have a purpose in the city. Because before that point, there wasn't really a purpose for humans. When we were hunter-gatherers, we just, you know, took care of our families and we, you know, just roamed from place to place until we exhausted the resources and then moved again. And then civilization allowed us to settle a place because we were growing the food and we could bring people in. and create an economy, and everybody had a purpose. And so that's where the idea of purpose comes about in this idea. And in order to have purpose, they had to invent a moral system. And I guess you could argue this is where monotheism comes from, because it gave the civilization control of the idea. But they had to tell people that there was a purpose in order to make them feel like it was worth it to leave their families, because up to that point, nobody had, and it was highly controversial. So they said, well, you have a purpose. You can come make this city better. You can pursue a easy life where you don't have to wonder where your next meal's coming from. You can come here and just rely on the work of other people who are all playing their part. And that's where the idea of the divine individual that I was telling you about earlier comes from, in this idea. So it's, you know, creating an incentive for people to leave the old way and come follow the new way, because it's not hard to imagine that would have been highly, highly controversial up to the hunter-gatherers.
That's interesting. You're outside of my realm of expertise there. That's really evolutionary and, I do history, I do text.
But is there anything that what can we know about this J source, the earliest source of the Old Testament? What do we know about it is what I'm, this is the source that wrote the creation account, the flood account, and what else?
Well, yeah, Adam and Eve comes from that. Part of the story of Abraham comes from that writer. Well, look at you referred to like four stories. You said the Eden story, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel's story, Noah and the flood, Abraham. What all of those four have in common, the sections that are all by the same author. And I'll throw in also the story of the destruction of Sodom, which is in that author's text also. What those five stories all have in common is that the environment suffers for human corruption. What we do morally not only affects us, it affects the cows and the trees and everything else.
Right, we're one with nature.
Yeah, you. I mean, you read the exact words where God says to Adam and Eve after the event of eating from the tree, the ground is cursed on account of you. And especially before that, there were no thorns. It's the story of why roses have thorns. Before that, everything was just swell. Right after that story is the story of Cain and Abel. And again, after Cain kills his brother Abel, God says, now the ground that received your brother's blood is cursed on account of you. So it's almost the same words he has said to Cain's father. And then you get the Noah account, where the entire universe suffers in this flood, where all the animal species and the plants and all are all going underwater. And it's only because God at the last minute says, oh, no, I can't wipe the whole thing out. So he saves this one family and the animal families. Otherwise, it would have been the end. And then the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where Abraham, you know, argues with God to try to save the city for the sake of the good people that might be there in the city. And it turns out they can't even find 10. So it gets destroyed. But it says not just people die. It says the whole city and the whole region, the plain, are destroyed. Everything is wiped out. So there's that notion that, you know, this isn't some modern 21st century super far left point of view about the environment. This is Bible, and in all of these, it reflects some notion that the things we do affect our world. I said infect by accident. Maybe I should let it stand. And then you say, well, then a lot of people think it starts with Moses. Well, you look at the Moses and the Exodus story, they need to use these 10 plagues to get the Israelites out of Egypt. And animals die, and plants die, and humans die. And the sun goes out, and the river turns to blood. It's like all of nature going crazy. And it's all to free a group of people from slavery. I mean, I don't know how many more examples we'd need. You could multiply these from the Bible, where the environment suffers because of human behavior. And that's an amazing thought. And you can take that left or right in your interpretations now. I told you last time, I don't try to make political points.
Right.
I'm just telling the story as I know it.
Well, the implications of that are true no matter what you believe. I mean, whether you believe in global warming or you think it's a hoax, you can't deny that in the Old Testament there is a clear story of human nature deviating from what nature intended, whether you mean God by nature or evolution by nature. It's the same thing you're saying. And at some point, it became unstable or unsustainable, and God or nature, whatever you mean by that, had to reset it. And there was a flood story that comes from the Bible is not the only book that depicts a flood story. I think we even borrowed it from the Babylonians, right?
Yeah, the Gilgamesh epic has a lengthy flood story, which has too much in common with the biblical one to be coincidence, and it's 1,000 years older, and it's similar.
And there's a bunch of those, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we know it because we've found it in more than one location in more than one language. We've at least have it in Akkadian and Sumerian. So yeah, they all knew about it in the ancient Near East.
And what's interesting is nobody really denies the flood anymore. When I was growing up, scientists denied that the flood could have even happened, but Christians and Jews were all in support of the flood actually happening. And now everyone says, well, this flood actually did happen. And they're saying another flood is likely if the polar ice caps continue to melt like they are.
Look, I would yield to a good oceanographer on the story of whether there's been a universal flood or not. I personally don't know the evidence of that, and I certainly don't see any way in which the biblical story reflects that. The Bible story, like the Gilgamesh epic, which has a flood story that's 1,000 years older and very similar, so we know they're connected, those things come out of reality. I mean, both in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, the main rivers, you know, the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia, the Nile in Egypt, have deltas that overflow every year. They really did have a flood every year. And it's perfectly natural that they would write flood stories. And the other thing is, even if you've never personally experienced a flood, fear of water is one of the most essential human feelings. If you've ever experienced near drowning and been pulled out, it's terrifying, terrifying feeling. And we really did all come from water, and our bodies are whatever they tell us now is at 93% water. It's not a surprise that there are a lot of essential stories in the Bible that involve water, whether it's the splitting of the Red Sea or it's the flood story or whatever. The Genesis chapter 1, the story begins that the universe is all water, and then God creates out of that. So whether there really was a universal flood or not, which I doubt, I understand why we have universal flood stories. That's something else.
Okay, interesting. So that was a perspective I hadn't considered. So you don't think there was actually a flood that was like a worldwide flood. You think that flood stories were just common because we just couldn't control it like we can now or something, like with dams and things like that?
Yeah, I personally have no knowledge of any evidence of the universal flood. But, you know, I was 30 years at UC San Diego, which has the Scripps School of Oceanography, which is the greatest school of oceanography in the world, I think. And I would absolutely yield if you get anybody from there who says, yes, as a matter of fact, there was a universal flood. I'll say, okay, fine. I always believe in going to the experts on the right things. You know, I don't try to pretend to be an expert where I'm not.
Are you trying to tell me you don't do all your fact-checking on BuzzFeed? It seems like people kind of tend to lump the Old Testament into different chapters. So they kind of take everything that happened before Moses and put it in a chapter, and they kind of look at those stories a certain way. And then they look at the Moses stories as maybe the beginning of the actual religious aspects of the book. And then you go on to like the Davidic part and all the way up until Esther. And people kind of read each of those chapters very differently.
Well, for some periods, look, we have more real archaeological and other literary evidence than others. On Genesis, there's hardly a thing that you can prove one way or the other. I mean, I can't prove that there was a person, Abraham. I can't prove there wasn't. Whereas when you get to Moses and the Exodus, you can start at least to evaluate portions of it. You know, in my book, The Exodus, I'm arguing that an Exodus is historical, if not exactly the way it's told in the Bible. And then by the time you get to the conquest in the book of Joshua, all the evidence to to us now, most of us are persuaded that it never happened. When you get down to the kings of Israel and all, I mean, we've got 15 of the kings mentioned in the Bible who are now mentioned in other archaeological sources we found, and every one of them in the correct period. So yeah, as you move down, you get better evidence. That doesn't make Genesis wrong, and it does, and it certainly doesn't make Genesis not valuable. It's tremendously that. What's amazing that they do choose to go back all the way to creation is something in itself. After all, these are ancient Jews, ancient Israelites writing these stories, and they're telling the story of their people and all. And if someone would say to you and me, well, tell the story of the United States, and we go, well, okay, well, first there was the Big Bang. And then in the first fraction of a second after the Big Bang, there was the breaking of cosmic symmetry. And then after that, there was the microwave background radiation. And then later, and we'd eventually get to, you know, Columbus or George Washington. I mean, we wouldn't do that. And if you started doing that, you would annoy the hell out of whoever asked you to tell the history of the United States.
And further on that point, most people wouldn't. Here's the thing that people who get off the boat with the Bible being the infallible word of God, period, word for word, is you can't take any history really that way. Look at what our own history books in America teach us about the origins of our nation. Even those have been changed to be more palatable and favorable to our story. I mean, we know that we didn't come in and have a picnic with the Native Americans on Thanksgiving. We know that we came in and did some awful stuff. And, you know, and it was terrible. And so history is always written by the victors, and you have to kind of take everything with a grain of salt.
Well, yeah. But the idea that they went all the way back prior to their own world, and they felt they had to set it in the context of the whole world. That is completely consonant with the ideas they had about that you treat foreigners the same as yourselves, and you love your neighbor as yourself. And God's first words to Abraham, first words to Isaac, and first words to Jacob all include, you'll do this because then you'll become a blessing to all the nations of the earth and all the families of the earth. So we put that together with that they go all the way back to creation. They're really thinking, you're not in this for yourselves. We're in this. We're all together.
We're together.
To me, that's amazing that somebody wrote that. That'd be amazing if somebody wrote it today.
I know.
Let alone that somebody wrote it that way thousands of years ago.
It's astounding. And you don't have to throw. I think a lot of people think if you read the Bible this way, you have to throw everything out, and that's not true. In fact, a more applicable narrative emerges when you read it this way. And I feel like if more people could get their heads around this idea that we might be capable of some real positive change.
Well, yeah. From your mouth to God's ear.
But, you know, the people of Israel, I've heard it argued that they would have read the Garden of Eden account as allegory and not a factual historical account. I mean, does that line up with your findings?
You know, I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't know if the author of that text, him or herself, or what he or she thought their audience was going to think, if they meant that story literally, or they knew they were just writing a beautiful tale to account for why we work and why we die and all of that. I really don't know. I mean, the story was written from sources. There are similar stories from Mesopotamia that are much older. So we know the author didn't just make it up out of nothing. And of course, if you're a religious person who believes in divine revelation, then you don't think that this author made it up at all, but was told that. So, do you like it when you hear a scholar answer a question with, I don't know, because I don't know?
Hey, actually, I love that because there's far too many scholars and lay people alike who will act like they do know the answers when they don't.
Oh, well, I don't know this one. I wish I did.
Every book I read on the subject until I found Who Wrote the Bible was telling me what to think before I even started reading the book. I came across this book by a guy named Josh McDowell, who I couldn't even get like two pages into it because I was like, I know what this guy wants me to think already. And then I read, you try to read Richard Dawkins and on the other side of the pole, and you're like, well, he clearly just wants me to think nothing about everything. So that's not helpful. It's really hard to find books like Who Wrote the Bible out there that just lay it out there from a cold, here's what's there, look at it for yourself and decide what you make of it. And I think there has to be more of that today. And that's why I love what you're doing.
Well, you know, I'm always cautious in how to say this because it's so easily misunderstood. On the one hand, I think you should trust better people who really are trained and know this. I mean, the two people you just mentioned can't read the text in the original unless I translate it for them.
Exactly.
So be cautious. The reason I say I have to be careful when I say that, I don't want to come across as arrogant in the way that only a Bible scholar can talk about this and everybody else in the world has to shut up and listen. I don't mean it like that. And I knew Mary Douglas, who was an anthropologist who read about the Bible. In my book, The Exodus, I cite Freud with great respect in what he wrote about Moses and the Bible. So I do understand that people who are not specialists can still make valuable contributions. But by the same token, right, you've got to be careful about someone then who isn't trained in the languages and the history and the archaeology and all of that that goes with it. If they have a super strong opinion on one side as well, that is a red flag.
You look at the Bible very differently than anybody else I've talked to that is qualified to weigh in on these topics, these conversations. What drives your curiosity about the Bible as somebody who clearly has a very specific perspective of it?
Well, I fell for it when I was a kid. And I mean, fell for it like you say, well, I fell for her, like I fell in love. I loved the stories. I stood in line to see the movie The Ten Commandments in 1956. I loved the movie too, and I was a consultant on the movie Prince of Egypt. So I mean, at every level of my life, I've just been awed by the greatness of this book and that's without having to close my eyes to the bad parts, you know, kill the Midianites, defeat the Amalekites. I mean, I'm aware that I never just wash that stuff away, but it's a tremendously powerful book. At times, it's got humor, it's got sex, it's got explanations. What? Yeah. Well, it's true. So yes, I've just been hooked on. Oh, that's what we'll call this conversation, hooked on Bible. I've been hooked on Bible my whole life. And
you wanted to make sense of it, maybe.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's real greatness there. I mean, look, my great hero in philosophy is Nietzsche. I think he was my man since I was 20. And Nietzsche, you know, was a professor, not of philosophy or psychology. He was a professor of classics. He took Greek and Latin, and his first books were on Greek literature, on tragedy. And Nietzsche said that even in Greek literature, even in all of Homer, he said, you don't meet characters as great as the ones in the Old Testament. He just recognized that. And there is this power there and an attraction, fabulous stories. And I do appreciate Greek literature. To me, you know, Oedipus is the greatest play ever written, but still, I find this special place for the Bible. If it's because it was also part of my religious life or not, because my parents knew it too, because my wife loves it, who can say?
I think we're drawn to stories as humans, and whether or not that's a product of evolution or just something we were taught to enjoy, it does seem like that some of the stories in the Old Testament that you see some of them kind of seem like plays. And what would we have done before we actually had plays and books and you know, technology to actually write these things down?
They did do it as performance originally. So yeah, before that was all written down.
How would they perform with no script?
Well, I don't know. In Greece, in Mesopotamia, they did the Enuma Elish that we now read as the Mesopotamian creation story. But we know they had a ceremony, the Akitu, where every year on the first day of the year, New Year's, which is always the first day of spring, they performed it. The god who is the wind defeating the goddess who is the waters and creating out of her. And you know, the Greeks did the same thing. That they did have texts of the great Greek tragedies, but you know, they always began with the sacrifice to Dionysus. I mean, theater was born as a religious performance, both in Greece and in Mesopotamia. And it's close to what you're talking about. I assume on some of those, they had a word for word they followed, and on others, they didn't.
It's fascinating. Are you familiar with this idea? Actually, it's not even did you know that in 1989, this is controversial. In 1989, the Hebrew School of Jerusalem confirmed that there was a mistranslation of the word calamus in the anointing oil recipe that God gave Moses. Supposedly it contained 9 pounds of calamus, which is a nutritionless swamp moss that was supposedly one of the main ingredients in the anointing oil. But in 1989, the Hebrew School of Jerusalem confirmed that it was actually its cousin plant, cannabis, which in Hebrew looks identical. So the idea is that there was 9 pounds of psychoactive cannabis in this anointing oil recipe, and the Hebrew School of Jerusalem backs this up.
I did not know that, but the next time I refer to God as the Most High, I'm really going to think about that.
The Most High. Oh my God. That's amazing.
Well, I never understood that until now.
That is amazing. That's hilarious. And there's also supposedly...
As long as everyone knows we're joking here, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
My great teacher, Professor Muffs, used to say, I don't joke lightly.
Yeah, well,
I thought that was great.
Unfortunately, you can't joke lightly anymore these days because everybody's so sensitive. I've worked in comedy the last 10 years, and it's just getting so hard to make comedic content because everybody's so freaking sensitive, and nobody can take a joke.
I did notice in a lot of the comments you got on our last talk together, a lot of people said, well, when are you going to start making those humorous YouTubes again? So people miss that.
I'm not done with comedy entirely, per se. I'm just, right now, I'm really enjoying making this podcast and talking to people like yourself. But who knows what the future holds?
My daughter wants a career in comedy. She's not as widely known as you are.
Well, I'm in the process of attempting to become less widely known, which is why I've decided to start this podcast.
Well, I think you're going to be plenty known through the podcast. I wish you the best with this. I did want to say that, I mean, you've been very complimentary about me and whatever my approach to scholarship and evidence and all that. And I do want to say that, you know, I'm not alone. I have a great many colleagues around the country, around the world, scholars who are good, honest scholars and smart and well-trained and who try to do the right thing. And I mean, there's plenty of bad scholars out there too, so you have to learn to tell the difference. But there's good people out there to ask, and there's good books to be read. And yeah, I want people to read mine, but I'm not alone.
Yeah, well, I think what's lacking is an availability of scholarly ideas on a consumer level. And maybe that's why you've had so much success with your books.
If you say we need more and more scholars who can write like that for the masses, it is very hard and we have to be trained to do it. And my first version of Who Wrote the Bible was rejected by 17 publishers.
And, wow.
I mean, there's always those stories like Harry Potter was rejected by everybody first and all that. And but
17 people told you no on that book?
17 major publishers rejected that book. And the one who finally took it was one of the ones who earlier had rejected it. And it ended up being published by Simon & Schuster, which was, you know, was the biggest then. And I had a great editor, and he helped me become a writer.
It
wasn't easy. And a lot of my colleagues, for all I know, have more talent than I do, but they weren't lucky enough to get Arthur as their editor like I was.
Well, I should probably do, there's probably going to be several follow-up episodes to this. A lot of people have been asking me to do a New Testament episode, but my intention with starting with the Old Testament is, I think you said this in the introduction for Who Wrote the Bible. If you're going to assess the authenticity of something, you must start at the foundation, and the Old Testament is the foundation of the Bible, and the Torah is the foundation of the Old Testament. So I've chosen to start here because it's the foundation and it's just the logical starting point. But I definitely I'm fascinated with the implications of this idea in a New Testament standpoint. And I think it still applies. I think some people, in my conversations, people have expressed the concern that if you take the idea that the early Old Testament was inspired by the origins of civilization and the separation from hunter-gatherer culture due to agriculture, that the New Testament is worthless. And I would argue that it's not worthless because, first of all, Revelation ends with civilization going up in smoke, but also because Jesus was the first to make a lot of the civilizational critiques that he made. And I think that's what made him such a prominent figure in that time, because he was saying things nobody had ever heard before. And it was controversial to Jews because they were like, well, you're not the Messiah. And he was like, well, yes, I am. And what they meant by Messiah is up for debate. Is it true that in the Old Testament times, Messiah was associated with a high priest or a king, not necessarily a savior?
Yeah, specifically, it doesn't mean savior. The word in Hebrew, the word mashach, means to anoint, and it means the anointed. So the kings and the high priests were anointed, and that's all it meant. That's what Christos means in Greek, too. I mean, Christ is a direct translation of Messiah, means anointed. And so that's all that would have occurred to them. I mean, David is referred to as the Messiah, and King Saul before him is referred to as the Messiah. And of course, that became transformed in Christianity and actually in post-biblical Judaism, too. The word Messiah, it came to mean something much, much bigger and universal than its original meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously, we're not going to get into the New Testament today, but what I was getting at earlier was that Jesus still had a lot of amazing things to say. And people say, well, Jesus was either a lunatic or he was who he said he was. And I would say, well, we're all kind of lunatics, right?
I'll admit I am.
Who's the first one to raise their hand and say they're not a lunatic? I mean, even Jesus called that out when people were stoning people, and he was like, raise your hand if you're the first to be without sin. We're all crazy, you know? So I just don't buy that if anything that we've just talked about is true, that none of it, nothing else after it makes sense. I just don't buy that.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting about Cain and Abel, that's kind of where we started this whole conversation. Cain was violent, and up until that point, if you look at it from a hunter-gatherer perspective, the world was violent before civilization, but it wasn't mean-spirited. Like, all the animals that would eat each other in the wild would cohabitate the same forests and the same areas, and they would just live in the same spots, and they would peacefully coexist. And then when it came time for feeding time, they'd all chase each other and eat each other. And once they got their catch, it was done, and everybody was safe again, and they'd come back and they'd eat. And that was just the way things worked. But Cain and Abel, if Cain was who this idea claims he was, the first person born into civilization, it would make sense that he was jealous of his brother, because civilization, the very nature of it, kind of keeps us at odds with each other. And I think that that's what Jesus talked about. I think that's why people didn't have a box for Jesus, because he was like, hey, this whole thing is good, but you guys got to stop hating each other.
What a radical idea. Stop hating each other.
And I don't think it has to be pessimistic, and I'm not trying to romanticize hunter-gatherer lifestyle. You know, I obviously think civilization's our best bet. You know, the best bet we have is to reconcile our differences with people who see the world differently than us, and to, you know, try to love everybody as if they're yourself.
Well, now there is a radical idea. The one idea that's really central to both the Old and New Testament is that one.
That message was handed down by how many generations over how many thousands of years? Like, that's unbelievable. It almost implies that we knew what we were getting ourselves into from the beginning, and that we knew that this nugget of truth was going to be vital to our existence.
Look, it's that or be a hermit. You know? Those are your two options.
I kind of want to be a hermit, I think.
No, don't do that. We lose the podcast.
Maybe I'll be a hermit in New York City. I'll just be like every other New Yorker.
A city of 6 million hermits. As a metaphor, that's kind of interesting.
It's the loneliest city in the world, right? And there's more people than any other place per square mile. It's kind of interesting. Well, Dick, this has been so awesome. Thanks for another conversation. And this was a lot of fun. Is there anything else you want to add before we close?
No, just thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. This is awesome. It's always a good time.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it again. Part 3. Take care. I want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Drop me a line in the comments if you're watching on YouTube.
And you're not just dropping me a line when you do that. You're literally connecting with all of the listeners. And I think the conversation about topics like this are so important. So definitely leave a note. And if you have something longer you want to send me, you can shoot me an email at hello@spellboundshow.com. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. And next week, I don't know who we're talking to yet because I've just got so many great episodes in the can. I'm just going to have to pick one, like Russian roulette. This has been so much fun making this podcast. I've loved learning with you guys. I hope you've been getting as much out of it as I have. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Look forward to seeing you guys next Monday. Have a great week.